If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Coming up, how hot and dry weather can reveal hidden underground features.
The artworks that baffle historians.
And celebrating Sir Tony Robinson's 80th birthday.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team Podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. And we should start by saying a very happy 80th birthday to Sir Tony Robinson.
Yes, I know we are a week or so late, but this is our first opportunity to say it on the podcast. So congratulations, Tony. It is a remarkable milestone that you have got to and still sounding so young and fresh.
Absolutely. I saw Tony not too long ago, actually, in Orkney. There's no way that guy's 80. I'm sorry, he just isn't. He's just got so much energy and still that same passion for the archaeology and for the history. It's wonderful to see. Many, many happy returns and congratulations, Tony. Looking forward to catching up with you again very, very soon. Right, this is a question and answers episode. So we've got a few questions here that have come in from Time Team members on Patreon. Got those to get to. Plus, of course, there's Helen's Find as well, where Helen's going to bring you an object discovered through archaeology with a bit of a story to tell.
First, though, we've got some exciting news to share. I would say that one of the things we get asked the most often is how people can join us to excavate a site. We're offering our Time Team members the chance to volunteer at our next 3-day dig.
Now, so far, all we can tell you is that it's a medieval site in the UK, specifically the Midlands, actually, and it's happening in October of this year. Now, places are very limited, and this opportunity is exclusively for our Time Team members. So if you're not one already, get yourself signed up. Go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial. If you are already a member, it is worth turning on your notifications, actually, on your Patreon account. And make sure as well that you're signed up to our Time Team newsletter to make sure you hear all the details first.
And speaking of details, Karenza Lewis is going to be with us next week on the podcast with a little more information on what you might be doing and how to apply for a place.
Yes, so more details coming next week when applications open. Shall we get down to the questions, I think, because there's been a few that have come in as usual, and Helen is going to be doing a wonderful job of answering them. Let's get this first one from Jaya. Hi, Jaya, who says, I've seen lots of social media posts about features being revealed due to the very dry weather and parched grass. Yes, here in the UK, we've had quite a long period, actually, of very hot, very dry weather, no rain in sight for an awful long time. And it has meant that all the grass has kind of died off. Jaya says, have any major discoveries been made from situations such as this? Yes, now these are parch marks, aren't they? And I we see lots and lots of images over the last month or so of, I don't know, gardens of stately homes being revealed in their former configurations. And you can tell because of where the grass has dried out quicker.
That's absolutely right, yes. They often tend to be these Tudor or Stuart gardens that survive under the landscape parks, which have not ever been ploughed. So they're very close to the surface of the grass. But the other thing that's coming up at the moment a lot is Roman villas, because this drought and these heat waves have been unusual in that they've also been in Wales and the far southwest. I mean, usually droughts are something of eastern Britain, although I don't think they got as far as Orkney, did they? It always seemed to be raining when you were on Orkney, Martin.
Yes, it was doing quite a lot of raining when I was on Orkney, yes. I don't think it quite reached that far north.
No, but in places like Wales and Devon and Cornwall, it's pretty rare to have a massive drought. And Roman villas have been turning up in these strange places that you're not expecting them, really new discoveries. And that's because the Romans were obviously building in stone and flooring in in ceramic much of the time, and those walls and floors contrast brilliantly with the stuff outside. I mean, when you're dealing with gardens, actually, you're looking at gravel. The Tudors and the Stuarts were really big into gravel, and they contrast with the deep flower beds, so they tend to be really beautifully obvious as it gets drier. So we've got Chatsworth with their 17th century garden. I think Blenheim Palace has rediscovered one that was known from plans but had never actually been seen, and that was built in 1705. We've also got other things. We've got some crop marks, which are completely different. They're kind of like the reverse to parch marks, and that's where ditches, these deep, dark, damp things, stand out because the crops stay green for slightly longer. And that kind of conversely to the parch marks, those come up in ploughed fields. So they allow us to discover prehistoric sites that are in lowland ploughed places. And this summer, I think we've had Cursus monuments that have been found near Milton Keynes and some Iron Age square barrows in Yorkshire. So those are really exciting as well. And even Stonehenge can produce new things in an unusual summer. About 10 years ago, some brown patches were photographed at Stonehenge, which filled in a bit of the circle. Now, I don't know if they've been investigated since, but you need to keep your eye on things, and you need to never take your eye off them, really, because the parch marks come up really quickly and they can disappear just as quickly. You've got to catch the moment as the grass is drying off, because sometimes just one shower of rain can kind of wake up the grass on a parch mark and make it all back to green again. Or if you get a day of hot sunshine, that can ripen your green crops in a day or two. And so the phenomenon just disappears. So you have to go out every day and take a photograph or put a drone up or just make sure you're looking. It can be total luck what you find and what you don't. So every summer, something new appears, not necessarily because it's dried out in a way it's never dried out before, but just that somebody was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, when I went to Bewley Palace, you know, Newhall School, where we found those...
The tunnels.
Yeah, for King Henry VIII's Tudor tunnels. On the top of there were those parch marks, and you could see the outline of the buildings that used to be part of Bewley Palace, which were demolished. And obviously we did know they were there from the time team digs that had taken place, but there they were. And you do think that there's probably lots of examples of those sorts of things, but where people didn't know that those buildings existed at all.
Yes, and at Newhall, you can just go upstairs, can't you, and look out of an upper window. But if it's somewhere that people don't go so often, hasn't got a building nearby, difficult to get up high, you've really got to keep your eyes open everywhere you go. Sometimes you can spot these things, you know, on satellite imagery. You're looking up on your sat nav or to find a grid reference or something, and you suddenly think, hang on a minute, because the satellite's just gone over at the right time.
Yeah, this is where the citizen science comes in, isn't it? You can, I'm sure there's armies of people trawling for parch marks, and you might make an amazing discovery. A great question, Jaya. Thank you very much for sending it in. Let's move on swiftly with question two, and then we'll get to Helen's find. Sarah says this: I have a question about questions. This is good, and I think this is right up your street, Helen. I work in outdoor education. This sounds fun. Mostly in woods, and I enjoy showing children and their adults all the tiny details they might not notice. Sometimes, however, the children ask me amazing questions themselves, prompting me to think about things from a different perspective, creating new insights. I wondered if the same is true in archaeology. When children come to visit sites or museums with their unassuming thoughts and unprimed imaginations, have their questions ever inspired you, Helen, to see things in a different way?
Oh, yes. Now, that is a great question, because children do often think of more interesting, kind of more left field questions than adults do. And the other thing is that they don't worry about looking silly. They don't worry that it's the wrong question. They don't really know what the right and the wrong questions are. So we get these really interesting questions that do make you think in a different way. I always remember a question that I heard about. It wasn't asked to me. It was asked to a friend who used to be an archaeologist, but she then retrained as a primary school teacher. Of course, every year she had to teach her class about the Anglo-Saxons. And one year, she must have been doing it with a huge amount of knowledge and passion, because one of her class said to her, "Are you an Anglo-Saxon?" And I've always found that, I mean, we did it because, you know, we laughed at this because we thought, oh, you know, how old did she think my friend was, you know, but it wasn't so much that. I think it was because it's really difficult to get the long passage of time. I think we know that with one part of our brain, but we forget about it. It's much easier to learn about what life was like in Anglo-Saxon times than it is to comprehend how long it was ago. And I think most 7 or 8 year olds, they find it quite hard to imagine that anything happened before they were born. It's something that they just don't know about. And even when we're quite grown up, it can be really difficult to imaginatively step back more than a few hundred years. I mean, that's why I find prehistory difficult, I think. I find anything before the late Iron Age, I mean, I know it, but I find it really hard to actually grasp, to understand, if you know what I mean. Anything more than a millennium just becomes a long time, and I can't really imagine it. So I always think about that child who asked that question. I mean, well, I don't think enough about it, to be honest. I should keep that idea always in my mind whenever I'm giving a talk or whatever, and remember that it's easy for me to say, oh, this was 40,000 years ago, or this was 10,000 years ago, or this was 6,000 years ago. But actually, it's difficult to get the difference between those into your mind.
It is, isn't it? But I'm still struggling to come to terms with the timeline of things. And I think I'm getting there. I think I'm learning a little bit more. But knowing how the Anglo-Saxon period relates to the Roman period, relates to, and where does medieval fit in with that? There's lots of sort of terminology that relates to time periods, and lining them all up is really difficult, even for me as an adult. And you can imagine then for children who are trying to work out how long ago something was without a real frame of reference. It is really quite difficult to do. And I do keep thinking that at some point on this podcast we should do a little kind of explainer, because I think it would help kids, if you're kind of teaching kids about it, would help to know the order that these different things happened in and how they related to one another. Even knowing the dates as well is, you know, goes in one ear and out the other for me sometimes, I have to admit. I know it's bad to say, but it does sometimes, and it can make it tricky.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was once asked to do an assembly for primary school, and I thought, well, I'll do some slides and I'll start off with a timeline because nobody knows these things. So off I went with my Tudors and my Stuarts and the medieval period and the Anglo-Saxons and the Romans. The Roman period is remarkably short, by the way, when you draw it out as a timeline. And then I went back to the Iron Age and I had to shrink everything to get it on the page. And then I got to the Bronze Age, and it had to be shrunk much more to get it on one slide. I gave up pretty quickly because you just couldn't see the Roman period when you were having to deal with the Bronze Age and the Neolithic. It was just too small to see. And given that primary school children, one of the few things they do know about is the Romans, I junked the whole slide, but it taught me something trying to make that timeline. So absolutely, I think it even archaeologists can be surprised at how periods that they think of as being much the same kind of length of time are not. And it's only when you try to do it graphically or with some kind of analogy. I remember Phil Harding on a Time Team special, I think it was, at Southampton Football Ground, standing in one goal. And he took a step out and he said, "Now I'm back to the Tudors now." And he took another step and said, "And now I'm back to the Romans." And then he pointed to the other end and said, "There's the Paleolithic right over there at the other end."
Oh, wow. It is just so difficult to get your head around. And how much changed in those tiny little footsteps of time, and then how much seemingly sort of stayed the same in that vast swathe of time from the goalpost to where he was. Very, very interesting stuff. Sarah, thank you very, very much for that. And we'd love to know more about the questions that you get asked. I think that would be very intriguing. More questions to come in just a moment then here on the Time Team podcast. But first, Helen's Find, which is the bit where Helen brings an object of archaeological significance or discovered through archaeology to your attention, and then talks a little bit about the story that it tells and why it's important. So what have you gone for this time then, Helen?
Well, after all the chat in the last few weeks about the Ness of Brodgers butterfly, I thought you might like to see another possible butterfly, and this is an Anglo-Saxon one. It's on the buckle that was found in Mound 17 at Sutton Hoo in the 1990s. Now, Mound 17 is the mound that's got the young man who's got a fairly rich burial, you know, kind of princely level, and he's buried with horse harness in his grave, and his grave is next to the grave of a horse. All of the objects are from there. Although they belong to the British Museum, they're on long-term loan to the National Trust. So you can find an image of it on the British Museum's record of its collections online. There's some really great drawings, but unfortunately, no photograph.
Yeah, I'm just looking through them now. And as I always say, by the way, the link to this is in the description of the podcast, so you can go and have a look for yourself. And you'll see lots of very beautifully done drawings. And I see the name as well here, excavated by Professor Martin Carver, a friend of the podcast who we know very well indeed.
Yes, well, it does say that it was excavated by Professor Martin Carver, but that was because he was the leader of the campaign of excavations. But actually, the person who physically took it out of the ground was Annette Rowe, who's a very, very talented excavator who we dragged over from where she was working in Italy to join the Sutton Hoo team. So she excavated it lying on a cradle and a mattress above the grave in the autumn of either 1990 or 1991. I can't quite remember. Yeah, so no photograph. I'm not quite sure why that is, because there is a photograph, a lovely colour photograph, in the publication of the cemetery. But the best way to see it is to go and see it on display at Sutton Hoo. Because it's on long-term loan, it's in this lovely display, which shows you how it was used. And you can see from the drawings, I mean, if you scroll along through the different drawings, you'll find a drawing that shows it as it was found, so right underneath the sword. So we think it was from a sword belt. But you can also see a drawing that gives you different kind of textures of stippling and colouring in for the different materials. Now, it's not made from gold like the buckles in Mound 1, but it's made from gilded copper alloy. So it would have had this gold coating to make it look pretty shiny and yellow before it was buried. But the copper alloy, of course, corrodes, expands a little bit. It doesn't look as great as gold does when it comes out of the ground, which looks absolutely perfect. So the butterfly is made from 10 garnets that are set in cells. So you've got two for each of the four wings, and you've got one for the body, and one little triangular one, which is probably some kind of schematic head. And then in between those 10 garnets, which makes the background against which the butterfly stands out, those are tiny triangles that are filled with blue glass down the centre, and apparently some kind of ivory inlay down the edges. But when you look at the photograph, you can see that the ivory is in really poor condition. I don't know if any work has been done to find out what kind of ivory it is, because obviously the connotations of ivory, say walrus ivory that's been imported from the north, or African elephant ivory that's come from Africa, or Indian elephant ivory that's come from Asia, they all represent different trade routes. So it would be good to know what that ivory is. But anyway, you've got your butterfly in the middle, and then that same motif that's used for the wings, that's a kind of oval with a line down the middle, that's used to make up what look to me like the petals of flowers above and below. There is nothing else like this in the world of early Anglo-Saxon cloisonné. Everything is generally pretty geometric. This figurative stuff, I mean, you do find figurative things in Sutton Hoo Mound 1, you've got people and animals and so on, but a butterfly amid flowers, it's such a pastoral kind of bucolic motif, and it's not what you'd expect for a buckle that's buckling on a sword. So what should we think about this? Should we think this is a personal choice of the young man in the grave? Was he a gentle soul who was keen on butterflies and flowers? Or is it the choice of the craftsman? In which case, why did the craftsman not appear to make any others that have survived? Or is that just an accident of survival? It's one of those things that we'll never necessarily know, but it helps expand our horizons.
Yeah, and it gives us a lot of questions to ask as well, more research to be done. It does look absolutely beautiful and almost, I would say, sort of fairly modern in design. I could imagine something like that being sold in Oliver Bonus.
Yes, I see what you mean, in that it's not naturalistic, and it's also not, kind of doesn't have that otherworldly, slightly barbaric look that a lot of Anglo-Saxon material has. You're right, it is quite modern. It's also not... it's not necessarily particularly well made. There isn't that kind of inhuman perfection that you get in Mound 1 stuff, which it looks almost like you've been down to the laser cutter to get it done. It's totally perfect.
Yeah, it's not quite symmetrical, is it? It's
no.
A slight little sort of, some of the shapes aren't quite the right shape that they should be to make it all line up perfectly, but I think that adds to it.
Yeah, it's a lovely thing, isn't it?
And you can go and see it for yourself if you fancy it. Like I said, I've left the link, which you can click on to get to the entry in the British Museum's collection, over in the description of this podcast.
This is the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams, and today I'm answering all of your questions.
Yes, and by the way, if you have a question that you want to submit to Helen for a future episode, because we like to do these question and answer sessions every now and again, really easy to do that. You just need to be a Time Team member, and you can join us on Patreon and submit your question in the chat section there. So patreon.com/timeteamofficial. And as we always say, I know we bang on about it a lot, but your support on Patreon does mean that we can continue to not only make the programs that we make, but do the archaeology. The support that you give us directly funds the archaeology that we do, and we are forever grateful for that. It is the reason that Time Team is back. So thank you very, very much indeed. Thank you, for example, to Andrew Brown, who is a Time Team member who's asked a question, and it says this: recently, and I quite like the picture that Andrew paints here, recently I was idly strolling along a road in Cambridge looking at the double yellow lines. what a wonderful day. When it occurred to me that centuries from now, an archaeologist might dig up a section of this road, see those lines, and reasonably categorize them as purely decorative. Yeah, I don't think you would naturally assume parking restrictions, would you? This made me wonder, is the scholarly consensus that markings on prehistoric pottery are also just decoration? Might some of these markings be akin to the yellow lines on the road, carrying a specific practical meaning about the pot's contents, its intended use, or something else entirely?
That is a fascinating question, and I've not heard any suggestion like that before, and I think that's a brilliant idea. The difficulty, perhaps, is designing experiments to test a hypothesis like that. And it occurs to me that you might be able to test contents by doing lipid analyses, which look at fats and waxes and so on that have soaked into the pottery. Or you could maybe look at actual use by looking at something like sooting on the outside or abrasion patterns and so on. Now, I know of two people who've done this for the early medieval period, not for prehistory. They're Julian Richards and our very own Paul Blinkhorn, who'll be very familiar to Time Team viewers. But let's start with Julian. This is the Julian D. Richards from York, who now mainly studies the Vikings. This is not Julian C. Richards, the prehistorian who often appears on the telly and mainly studies the landscape of Stonehenge. Now, Julian D. Richards did his PhD on early Anglo-Saxon cremation urns, and he found some correlations between the size of the urns and their decoration and the kinds of people whose bones were buried in them. But they weren't particularly strong correlations. What's really nice is that in the years since, other people have worked on those findings, trying to refine them. In the end, I think the jury's still out. We don't know whether something like the hot cross bun stamp that we found on stamped cremation urns at Sutton Hoo, might that mean the person buried in a hot cross bun stamp pot. Maybe they were a fantastic baker of hot cross buns. Or did the stamp meant that you kept something like a malted grain in it? That would need quite a big pot. Would you have used that for a big person? We just don't know at the moment. We have to carry on asking the questions and hope that at some point we get enough data to be able to say something clearer than yes, quite possibly, which is what we're saying at the moment. Now, Paul has managed to do a bit more work on something called Ipswich ware. Ipswich ware is probably the most fascinating pottery ever made. Or it's possible that because Paul has spent his life looking at it and he's such a good person at telling stories about pottery, he's just convinced us that Ipswich ware is the most exciting pottery ever made, because it is grey and dull looking, but it is, when you read about what Paul says, you just think, wow. Ipswich ware, in short, is the first wheel-made pottery after the Romans have left. It starts being made sometime in the early 8th century. It's all apparently made in Ipswich, and it filters out through East Anglia and sometimes to further flung parts of the country. Paul's written a book on it and has tried to work out everything he can about it, from what it was used for to how people saw it to how it travelled, etc., etc. Paul's also looked at this thing that Julian called the communicative significance of decoration. And he found, Paul found, that if you looked at stamped Ipswich ware, stamps were only found on large jars. And Paul wondered, I mean, maybe this says more about Paul than it does about Ipswich ware. He wondered whether one particular stamp, which is the triangle with the point downwards, maybe that had something to do with alcohol, because he pointed to the way that in which early Anglo-Saxon buckets, like the ones that we found on the time team at Bremer, and small cups like ones you get at Sutton Hoo, they're also often decorated with the same triangles, and we also think that they're to do with alcohol. The problem is that you can't use lipid analysis, as I understand it, to find alcohol. So you can't test that hypothesis. Lipid analysis is brilliant for things like bacon or dripping, the animal fats. It can also find milk fats. So you can tell butter, cheese, milk from things like bacon or lard. And then there are even animal waxes. I mean, I know that sounds weird, but think of beeswax. That's made by an animal, and that can suggest that honey was kept in a jar. And then you can also get plant waxes, things like beans and cabbage. You know how sometimes if you wash a cabbage leaf, the water just rolls off it, and that's because it's actually quite waxy. So those are the things you can find, but I don't know that there's any correlation between those and Ipswich ware decoration. And Ipswich ware is probably the type of pottery that has had more work like this done on it than any other kind of pottery. So I think it's going to be one of those questions that we just need more data for. And that endless light bulb joke of, we don't know, we just need more data. But yeah, don't forget also that a pot is only made once and decorated once, but it's used over and over and over again for possibly different things. Now, I keep my rice in a big glass jar marked wholemeal flour, and I've kept my rice in that for a really long time. My mother-in-law maybe kept her wholemeal flour in it. I inherited it from her. But my pens are kept in a pot marked marmalade. The fact that something's got a label on the outside saying what the maker wanted to use it for or thought we would use it for doesn't mean that's how it actually was used. So that adds an extra layer of complication. But I really hope that as lipid analysis gets more and more sophisticated and cheaper, and more people do it, I hope that eventually we might be able to get enough data to answer Andrew's question. But at the moment, it's a brilliant question, but we haven't got enough data yet.
Imagine you are an archaeologist in, I don't know, 500 years' time, and you do what Andrew suggests with the double yellow lines on the road in Cambridge, and you dig them up and you find these two yellow things. Do you think the archaeological process, certainly the one that exists now, would be able to identify that as serving a purpose? Or do you think it would conclude it was decorative?
Well, it's really difficult because the signs that give you the text that explains what the double yellow lines mean don't have double yellow lines on them. Which is weird, isn't it, when you come to think of it? We all know what double yellow lines mean. I suppose it's in the highway code that we all learn when we do our cycling proficiency or bikeability or our driving lessons. Because I can't think of a situation where you would know. I mean, obviously, you're not going to see a snapshot of it in use. You're not going to, unless there's some kind of incredible landslide that preserves the layout of cars parked on the road, and you can see that the double yellow didn't have any on them, but everywhere that wasn't double yellow did. The likelihood of that would be, it would be as unlikely as finding a complete skeleton of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. These things happen, but they don't happen very often. In the normal way of things, I don't think you'd ever be able to tell, no.
It's just interesting. It just makes you think, and I wonder what we've got wrong. I wonder what we've interpreted as something completely nothing to do with what it actually was. And if somebody was to get in a time machine and join us here in the future, they'd go, what on earth are you saying that was used for? You've got to be joking, haven't you?
Yeah, that's why I feel that archaeology really, we're not trying to reconstruct the details of some lost truth. We're trying to find out more about what we think. How we choose to interpret something says more about us than it does about this truth that we can never really get back to. So somebody might interpret double yellow lines as decorative because they love to decorate their environment. That's what's important to their society or to them then. Other people might think it's got a ritual significance if they're very keen on superstition and doing things in different times of the year to give a routine. It just does say more about us than it does about what really happened all those years ago.
I've got one more question, and I think it's the perfect question to end this episode on, because we started this episode by wishing Sir Tony Robinson a happy 80th birthday. I appreciate we were a few days late, but this was our first opportunity to do it. And Rick has got in touch. Rick is one of our time team members who says, in honour of Sir Tony's birthday, what is your fondest memory on a dig with him? I might go first, Rick, because mine's very, very recent, because when we were in Orkney, I arrived on the day of the World Cup final. I went into John Gator's local pub, where he now lives on Orkney, to be greeted by John Gator, Tony Robinson, and the whole of the Time Team production crew, all gathered around the TV watching the World Cup final. Now, that is not a situation I ever thought I'd be in, but what an amazing time we had, and what an amazing time it was. So that's what my answer's going to be, but I'm sure that Rick is particularly interested, not in my answer, but in yours, Helen.
Well, I've got so many little memories of tiny things that Tony has helped me with, how to construct a story, how to know when to stop talking, particularly in live television, which is so, so terrifying. You know that you're in the hands of somebody who knows exactly what they're doing and will take you through it and will teach you by example. So many little tips he's given me. But I think my fondest memory of Tony really surprising me is not actually on a Time Team dig. It's something entirely different. In 2002, I was volunteering for the All-Party Archaeology Group, the All-Party Parliamentary Archaeology Group, which is a cross-party, cross-House of Lords, cross-House of Commons group of people who are interested, parliamentarians who are interested in archaeology. They take evidence from experts and they do inquiries and they write reports. In 2002, they were writing a report on the current state of archaeology in the United Kingdom, because people had got really irritated with many aspects of how we were paying for archaeology, how we were organising it, and so on. I was one of the volunteers who was helping compile the evidence. And as part of all of that, there were evidence sessions in the House of Lords committee rooms, and both Mick Aston and Tony Robinson took part. It was just at the beginning of me being involved with Time Team, and of course I was used to Mick sounding really authoritative and really expert. But Tony, I didn't know him very well, and I felt that he was like our comedian, he was our everyman, he was our man on the Clapham omnibus, so to speak. I didn't know his hidden depths. I didn't know at that point that he'd had a long career within the Actors Union Equity. He was absolutely no stranger to briefing parliamentarians, to lobbying them, in fact, telling them what they needed to know, telling them what they needed to change to make the country a better place. And he was absolute dynamite. in about 5 minutes, he had told them every single thing that was wrong with the way that we handled our archaeology, the way that we did it, and how it should be fixed, what we needed to provide locally, nationally, how it should be funded, how government ought to treat it, how important it was, how we could make it fairer, how it should be presented to the public. It was all there. It was incredibly clear. It was all done in this brilliant storytelling way with incredible confidence. And I just thought, my goodness, what this man can do. You know, he doesn't just turn up on site and ask a few questions. He really knows his stuff. Now, I shouldn't really have been surprised in a way, because this was off the back of 10 years of Time Team, constant tuition from Mick to Tony. But it was so impressive. And from someone who wasn't even a professional archaeologist, his actual job was an actor, and yet he blew my socks off. I'll never forget it.
Yeah. Well, he is just a consummate professional and just brilliant at everything he turns his hand to. Mm. And you can just see, you know, when you see him on set, but you know what I mean, by the side of a trench, you know, ready to go with a camera, and they say action, and he just springs into life, and you can see the brain working at a million miles an hour, being able to take you round and tell you in such an easy to understand way exactly what is going on, why it's important, how it fits in with the story that's being told in the sort of wider picture of what they're trying to do. And that's just what he does with Time Team. If he can turn his hand to that so brilliantly, it's no surprise really that he's able to turn his hand to being in front of some parliamentarians and sort of telling them what's what and how the country can be improved. So I've got absolutely no doubt that he was fantastic at that. Well, I think that's a really nice way to end this podcast, you know, and yeah. Great to celebrate Sir Tony in his 80th year, and another happy birthday from us to you, Tony. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. If you, and I mentioned this earlier, if you do want to suggest a question for Helen for a future episode, really easy to get involved with the podcast. You do need to be a Time Team member, but if you go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial and just look in the chats section, you'll see it there. Really easy. It just says podcast questions for Helen, and you can just get involved with the chat there. I read everything that comes in, and I choose ones to put in as part of the podcast. Go and do it now, patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
And next week, you'll hear from Carenza Lewis, who's got more details about that fantastic opportunity for Time Team members to join us on an excavation in October. And you'll find out more about a Time Team expedition crew trip to Kielder in Northumberland. Lawrence Shaw will tell you what's drawn him to such an enigmatic landscape.
We'll speak to you in a week's time then on the next episode of the Time Team podcast. Bye for now.
Bye.